When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Mail checks, invoices, documents, and everything you need to keep your business running. Get rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS. And with the mobile app, you can take care of mailing on the go. Make the same no-brainer decisions as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up at Stamps.com with code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.
Fluffy bread, classic burger buns, and so many carbs. Carb fear is real, but Hero Bread makes healthier versions of the carb-heavy favorites we love most. We're talking fewer calories, 0 to 2 grams net carbs, zero sugar, and seriously great taste. Plus, more of the dietary fiber and protein you want with no compromise. Don't skip out on your favorites. Just use Hero Bread. Get 10% off your order at hero.co with code HEROPOD at checkout.
Welcome to the History Unplugged podcast, the unscripted show that celebrates unsung heroes, myth busts historical lies, and rediscovers the forgotten stories that changed our world. I'm your host, Scott Rank. If you're the leader of a nation, does it pay to be completely crazy? Does it pay to be absolutely unhinged? If you're not in a democracy, if you work as a dictator or maybe a monarch in times past, the answer appears to be yes. And I should note that you can't just do it halfway. If you're going to be unhinged, you have to go absolutely all out. An eccentric autocrat can stay in power for decades in spite of, or actually because of, his ostensibly insane power. And I'm not just throwing this out here as a hypothetical. These are the exact questions that people ask themselves after the death in 2011 of Libyan dictator Colonel Muammar al-Qaddafi. He managed to hold on to power in the North African nation for 42 years, despite his highly eccentric behavior. Before his death, he became infamous for an incoherent speech at the United Nations, in which he asked whether swine flu was man-made, and you can see a good parody of this on Saturday Night Live. He offered to move the United Nations headquarters to Libya to prevent jet lag, among other world leaders, saying it was more centrally located than New York, and suggested that Israel and Palestine be combined into one state called Israeline. At other times during his really long rule of his country, he used his position to call for the end of Switzerland and contemplate conspiracy theories such as Israeli intelligence assassinating JFK. He was escorted by an all-female contingent of bodyguards, also was parodied in the movie The Dictator. He wrote a book of teachings called The Green Book that claimed to offer the answers to all human problems in three parts. The first, the solution to democratic problems, then the solution to economic problems, and finally, the solution to social problems. Qaddafi also put to death anyone who was perceived to threaten his regime, and he had the resources to locate these would-be plotters. An estimated 10 to 20% of the population were state security informants. Libya was the most censored country in the Middle East and North Africa in 2011, according to the Freedom of the Press Index. Qaddafi's strong-arm policies let his citizens know how they would be treated if anyone fell out of favor with him. Earlier in his reign, he expelled Libya's Italian community, exhumed bodies of Italians from Libyan graveyards, and broadcasted the gruesome spectacle on television. Because of his paranoid, eccentric rule, Libyans were willing to take up arms against him during the Arab Spring uprising of 2011, when NATO declared Libyan airspace a no-fly zone, enabling rebels to hunt down Qaddafi and his sons. But their overthrow only raises the obvious question that everybody was asking. Why didn't Libyans rebel decades sooner and save them all this misery? Qaddafi had always been a crazed leader. He didn't suddenly begin to curtail human rights and promote himself at the end of his reign so bombastically. How could any dictator who had such a loose relationship with reality last so long? David Brooks of the New York Times argued that it was precisely because of his insanity that he reigned for nearly half a century. If a leader wants to crush the rule of law and any hint of a democratic process, Brooks said, he is far better off completely destroying any means of a civil society than leaving remnants of it around that support human rights to remind the people what they are missing. He said, "The paradoxical fact is that if you want to stay in office as a dictator, it's better to be a narcissistic totalitarian than a run-of-the-mill autocrat. Megalomaniacs like Qaddafi seek to control every neuron in their people's heads and to control every aspect of life. They destroy all outside authority in civil society. They personalize every institution so that things like the army exist to serve their holy selves rather than the nation at large. They are untroubled by doubt or concern for the good opinion of others, since they already possess absolute truth. They are motivated to fulfill the world historical mission and have no interest in retiring peacefully to some villa. Jean Kirkpatrick was right years ago to make the distinction between authoritarian dictatorships and totalitarian ones. The totalitarian ones are both sicker and harder to dislodge. Gaddafi's unhinged narcissistic oddness seems to be the key to his longevity. So remember, if you're going to be a tyrant, be a wacko. It's safer. So in this episode, I'm going to be looking at the lives of some of the most unhinged leaders in history and how they guided the destinies of their countries or their states or their monarchies or duchies with only a very loose connection to reality. Now, there are different types of insane leaders, and we're going to be looking at two different categories of them. The first suffered from mental illness and psychological disorders. These include such leaders as George III, infamously the leader of Britain during the American Revolutionary War. He suffered from the hereditary blood disease porphyria, as did many other European monarchs, who were all loosely related. Another member of this type is Ibrahim I, the Ottoman Sultan, who is known today in Turkey as Deli Ibrahim, or Ibrahim the Mad. He was in prison for several decades before he became a ruler that, due to his miserable upbringing, caused sociopathic tendencies, leading him to do such things as practice archery on his court subjects. The second type of mentally unhinged ruler suffered from self-inflicted madness by being intoxicated with power, like Gaddafi. They slid into a condition of megalomania and self-aggrandizement by isolating their nations and being surrounded by sycophants who never questioned their decisions or were too afraid to. This includes such 20th century autocrats as Albanian head of state Enver Hoxha, who did such things as ruin the national currency by making it conform to his superstition with astrology. Another person that I am really intrigued by and will talk at length about is former Turkmenistan president for life, Akbar Turkmenbashi, who renamed constellations and days of the week after himself and his mother. So while such stories are amusing, the idea I want to explore is the addictive nature of power and the effects it has on those who cling to it for too long. But also, what does it mean about the structure of power when somebody who doesn't have their full mental faculties can manage to be moderately successful for decades and somehow their nation doesn't completely collapse? Is it because they have good checks and balances? Or maybe a ruler or head of state doesn't have the power they say they do? Or maybe their reign just gives us an example of what social collapse looks like. But because we have enough examples in history of people who aren't all mentally there ruling a nation, it raises the question of why society tolerates them for so long. Finally, I want to look at if the tendency of unhinged rulers is more of a relic of the age of monarchs, and when you have hereditary rulership, where the son or daughter needs to be on the throne, and due to inheritance laws in the Middle Ages, you're incentivized to put a family member in power. So we'll look at the question on whether rulers who are mentally unstable and don't just have delusions of grandeur are a relic of earlier times, or they'll still be with us for the long haul. The first person to discuss among history's most insane rulers is Roman Emperor Caligula. And in my discussion of all these insane rulers, I'm going to have to do a lot of caveats because when historical sources are describing the outlandishness of a ruler, many times they're not looking for historical fact, but they have an agenda for doing so. And we have to constantly question and interrogate the sources. And I'll get into that in a second, but really, come on. We want to hear fun stories about how crazy some rulers could be. So I'm going to give you that right off the top. I'm going to talk about Caligula, claims about him, not saying they're necessarily true, and I'll explain all those caveats after I get into the crazy stories about Caligula, so let's jump right in. If you know about Caligula, you might know about the very infamous 1979 movie, which is as wide release as porn can possibly get. I haven't seen it, really don't care to describe scenes in the movie, but that is the most recent depiction of Caligula in popular media. Now, something that happened a little bit before that was actually a painting that artist Salvador Dali produced in 1971. And when he set out to paint a depiction of the infamous Roman emperor, he chose to depict the thing nearest and dearest to the crazed emperor's heart, his horse, Incitatus. The painting, Le Cheval de Caligula, shows the pampered pony in all his royal glory. It's wearing an opulent crown and clothed in fine garments. While the gaudy clothing of the horse is historically correct, according to some sources, for once in his life, the Spanish surrealist artist is guilty of severe understatement. Caligula, who reigned from 37 to 41 AD, was the first emperor with no memory of the pre-Augustan period and therefore had no compunction about establishing a personality cult, ruling with absolute autocracy, demanding his subjects' worship, and treating his horse better than royalty. According to the Roman historian Suetonius, he gave Incitatus 18 servants, a marble stable, an ivory manger, rich red robes, and a jeweled collar. He required that those passing by bow to his horse and demanded that be fed oats mixed with the flecks of gold and wine delivered by fine goblets. Dignitaries were forced to tolerate the horse as a guest of honor at banquets. This episode was but one example of the deranged excesses to which Caligula lived and what led to his violent death at the hands of his enemies. In the four short years that Caligula served as the Emperor of Rome, he built for himself a reputation as a man who is completely committed to his lusts at the expense of his empire. He uses authority, influence, and wealth to satisfy his sexual appetite, build his own ego, and antagonize the Roman Senate. This behavior is thought to have been the primary reason he also went down in history as the first Roman emperor to be assassinated. He's the third child born to Germanicus, the legendary Roman general and adopted son of the Emperor Tiberius, and grandson of the Emperor Augustus on his mother's side. So he'd grown up around Roman soldiers and powerful leaders. His youth was rife with difficulties, though. In 19 AD, Caligula's father died under questionable circumstances, leaving his mother, Agrippina the Elder, to manage a strenuous relationship with the Emperor Tiberius. Shortly after the death of his father, Caligula was sent to live with his great-grandmother, Livia. When she died 2 years later, he was sent to live with his grandmother, Antonia. When the Emperor Tiberius took ill and secluded himself on the island of Capri, he called for Caligula to be with him there on the island. In 31 AD, Caligula accepted the invitation and went to tend to his adoptive grandfather. During that time, Emperor Tiberius ordered the exile of Caligula's mother and two brothers. They later died, leaving him as the sole male heir of Germanicus. It's said that even in his illness, Tiberius could tell that Caligula was not suitable to reign. The emperor referred to him as a viper that he thought would be unleashed on all of Rome. So Caligula was assigned only menial tasks and held no major offices between 31 and 37 AD. When Tiberius died in 37 AD, the Roman people received their new emperor with open arms, largely based on the fact that his father, Germanicus, had been so popular and well-loved. They were hopeful for a ruler who would demonstrate more warmth and charity than had Tiberius, who was notably isolated and stingy during his decades-long reign. The beginning of Caligula's reign did go well. He was a strong leader, compassionate, smart, and decisive. His first order of business was to pay off all the former emperor's debts. He also honored his slain family by retrieving their remains and giving them a proper Roman burial. He gave the Praetorian Guard a handsome bonus, recalled all exiles, and compensated those whom he thought had been wrongly taxed. Not long into his reign, however, he fell ill and is said to have slipped into a coma. When he awoke, he was a very different man. And again, different sources have different accounts, so we don't know how much salt to take with all of these facts. Caligula had Tiberius Gemellus killed, who was his joint successor, and began to pursue the sexual appetite he had for his female siblings. He particularly liked his sister, Drusilla, whom he later married and impregnated. Not only did he have conjugal relations with them, but he also prostituted them out to other men, effectively turning the palace into a brothel. After Drusilla's death, Caligula married twice more. Both marriages were short-lived. In 38 AD, just 1 year after taking office, he married a fourth time to Melania Caeconia. Caligula was not at all concerned about the expansion of his empire, nor did he allocate any resources to defeating his enemies. In just a few months, he managed to waste the entire fortune left by the Emperor Tiberius, a fortune it had taken the former emperor 22 years to collect in tribute. In an effort to increase the amount of money available for his personal use, Caligula ordered all wealthy citizens to name him as the sole heir to their estates upon their deaths. Once that law was in place, he then began a campaign of falsely accusing, fining, and killing wealthy citizens to get their money. He also tried and killed his wealthiest subjects for treason on charges of blasphemy so that he might receive their estates. He levied taxes on everything from marriage to prostitution and caused starvation in parts of his empire by claiming large areas of arable land for his own private use. He auctioned the lives of gladiators and claimed the plunder that soldiers had acquired from spoils during war. Despite the fact that he quickly depleted the treasury and began heavily taxing his subjects, Caligula embarked on several vanity construction projects. He wanted a giant floating bridge built across a bay in Naples in order to prove wrong the astrologer Tresillus, who said that Caligula had no more chance of becoming emperor than of crossing the Bay of Baiae on horseback. According to the Roman historian Suetonius, he crafted a solution by doing the following. He devised a novel and unheard-of kind of pageant, for he bridged the gap between Baiae and the mole at Puteoli, a distance of about 3,600 paces, by bringing together merchant ships from all sides and anchoring them in a double line, after which a mound of earth was heaped upon them and fashioned in the manner of the Appian Way. Over this bridge, he rode back and forth for two successive days, attended by the entire Praetorian Guard and a company of his friends in Gallic chariots. As he rode back and forth on horseback, Caligula made sure to wear the breastplate of Alexander the Great to shore up his military bona fides. He never actually attempted to go to war, but he did commission the construction of two large warships that eventually burned without ever having been sailed. The closest he came to participating in war was in the 39 to 40 AD campaign, when he went to Gaul and marched to the shores with the military with the intent of invading Britain. Before his army launched its attack, he ordered them to stop and collect seashells. He called these the spoils of the conquered ocean and ordered his troops home. Caligula was perpetually disrespectful of the Senate, who during the reign of Tiberius had done much of the decision-making on their own, as Tiberius was quite antisocial. In response to their disapproval of him, Caligula did what he could to shame, embarrass, and humiliate Senate members, both individually and collectively. One famous incident involved his beloved horse, Incitatus, whom Caligula clothed in the finest robes, suitable for most any member of the nobility. Oftentimes when invitations were sent from the palace, they were in the horse's name, and Incitatus was allowed to eat dinner at the emperor's table. And it was claimed indirectly in some less reliable Roman sources that Caligula attempted to make Incitatus either a senator or a priest before his death. Caligula fully embraced emperor worship and encouraged others to worship him as a god. While previous emperors tolerated this practice, he allowed it and attempted to require it in the Roman provinces. Caligula tried to construct a huge statue of himself inside the temple in Jerusalem, the center of Jewish worship. This action would have nearly guaranteed a revolt from the Jews, who would have considered the construction a pagan slap to the face of their religion. Herod Agrippa, the descendant of the man who is said to have slaughtered dozens of infants in an attempt to kill Jesus, even considered this a terrible idea and convinced the emperor to relent. It was this consistent and unrelenting disrespect that eventually led to his murder. In early 41 AD, in a secluded hall in the basement of the palace, Caligula was stabbed 30 times in an attack led by Cassius Chaera, a guard whom Caligula had humiliated on multiple occasions. The painful and bloody attack didn't kill the emperor right away. But by the time his guard found him, the conspirators were long gone, and he eventually succumbed to his injuries. His wife Caeconia and their infant child were murdered as well. Few sources contemporary with his life have survived, and his legacy is a bit open to embellishment. That's an understatement. But nevertheless, nearly all historians agree that his cruel temperament and extravagance defined him as an emperor. They made for a legacy that far surpassed any positive contributions he gave to Rome.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Now, I said earlier that it's really tricky when we use sources that talk about the complete instability and insanity of a ruler. And let me just step back for a second and use Caligula as an example of how tricky that is. Now, if you're a fan of Roman history, your toes might have curled by a few things I said there. You would have thought, he really thinks that happens? That statement about Caligula is by a completely unreliable source, or it's an embellishment that was made decades or centuries after Caligula's life, and it wasn't a firsthand account at all. It was a story, not really about Caligula, but it was the writer trying to make a point about the time in which they lived. So how could he actually believe that's true? Well, you're right. There is a lot about Caligula that sounds so over the top, it sounds completely fictional. Like that account of him riding back and forth on a boat for 2 days or claiming the inheritance of every single person in the empire. How could you possibly even enforce that? How could you not have a massive revolt on your hands if you single-handedly try to steal the wealth of everyone? Nobody was that powerful that they could do something like that, not even an emperor of Rome. And there's lots of things that are claimed by some in history about Caligula, about, like I said, incest, regicide, even pedophilia, rape, and all sorts of other things. Well, most of what we know of Caligula's life comes from six ancient writers. Seneca the Younger and Philo of Alexandria knew him personally. Tacitus and Josephus were born too late to know him, but they knew many people who knew him, so that makes them fairly reliable. Now, Suetonius, who has much negative to say about him, and Dio lived long after Caligula's death, 80 or 190 years after his reign, respectively. So those very wild accounts happen about 100 years after the fact. And you have to ask yourself, how likely is it that something written decades after somebody's life is more accurate than a firsthand account? And why wouldn't the firsthand accounts say those things? This gets into issues of historical criticism. How do we critique sources? And historians have dealt with this for over a century, and they'll put forward different procedures for source criticism in history. That if all sources agree about an event, that you can consider it mostly to be true. But when sources disagree, you should prefer the one with the most authority, specifically eyewitness accounts. And you also have to ask, when you have a source, when was it written? Where was it produced? Was it produced close to the events in question? Who was it produced by? Was it someone who had an ideological axe to grind? And with other factors, we can litigate a source. Now, there are cases in history where we have a historian writing two different sources under two different circumstances, and we can get a taste of how wildly events can diverge. And we even have an example from the Byzantine historian Procopius, who talks about how his patron Justinian is insane, but he doesn't say that in another source, and we have reason to believe that he's embellishing for a political agenda. So I say all this to make you aware, dear listener, that when we talk about the insanity of a ruler, we have to be very careful. Let me just give an example of Procopius because he has a really interesting story. So Procopius had a front row seat to the most important events of the 6th century. He accompanied the Roman general Belisarius in the Wars of Justinian, the wars between Rome and Sassanid Persia, the Vandal War of Belisarius's successful campaign against the Vandal Kingdom in Roman Africa, and the Gothic War, the campaign by Belisarius to recapture Italy, then under the rule of the Ostrogoths. Procopius also wrote a panegyric for Justinian. A panegyric is a formal speech or written work that is meant for high praise of a person. It's not fact. It's kind of like a eulogy at a funeral or a public relations official. And that was the book The Buildings of Justinian, where he presents him as an idealized Christian emperor who builds churches for the glory of God and defends his subjects and builds aqueducts because he cares about his citizens' health. But there was another history of Justinian that was only discovered 1,000 years after his life called The Secret History. It covers the same periods as the books on the history of Justinian's wars, but there's a completely different take on Justinian and his wife, Empress Theodora. We get the sense that he's become deeply disillusioned with him. Justinian is portrayed as cruel, incompetent, and venal, and Theodora, who was a former circus performer, which was practically a prostitute in those days, is portrayed as having absolutely endless lust, and she's mean-spirited, shrewish, and calculating and cruel. And he has accounts of Theodora in her circus days performing almost naked in front of people and doing things with animals that would get you arrested today for public indecency. I won't get in the details. And there's another account where he describes Justinian as basically a demon. He was a monster whose head could vanish, at least according to this passage. Here's what it says. And some of those who have been with Justinian at the palace late at night, men who are pure of spirit, have thought they saw a strange demoniac form taking his place. One man said that the emperor suddenly rose from his throne and walked about, and indeed he was never wont to remain sitting for long, and immediately Justinian's head vanished, while the rest of his body seemed to ebb and flow, whereas the beholder stood aghast and fearful, wondering if his eyes were deceiving him. But presently he perceived the vanished head filling out and joining the body again, as strangely as it had left it. So why does he write such two different accounts? Was he paid by Justinian and he had to write a complimentary account of his life, but secretly he hated him, so he wrote his secret histories, hoping that at some point in the future, historians would find out the real story? Maybe, but historians have also argued that Procopius feared that a conspiracy could overthrow Justinian, so he had to hedge his bets. He wrote an exaggerated and prepared an exaggerated account to show, oh, I secretly hated Justinian all this time. So if an enemy came to power, he could clear himself of all accusations of proximity with the former imperial power. So this was merely Procopius hedging his bets rather than actually trying to write history. But if we were to take the secret histories at face value, we would assume that Theodora is nothing but a circus prostitute. Justinian is actually a demon and completely incompetent. So we have to look at the agendas of the writer himself and triangulate that against different sources. One last example I'll give of how stories can come centuries after the fact is Constantine V. He was another Byzantine emperor. He ruled in the 700s, but long after his life, he was given the name Copronymus, meaning dung-named or poop-named, absolutely hated to the core by future Byzantines. And that's because he was an iconoclast. He destroyed religious pictures. So because of this, nearly all surviving Byzantine icons are from later periods than this, when icons were restored. Constantine thought that Christ or God could not be depicted. That's because of his divine nature. And you can't circumscribe the divine nature into an image. Constantine convened a synod filled with other iconoclast bishops, and they agreed to go on a campaign to remove the images from the walls of churches and purge the court and bureaucracy of other sorts of icons. Constantine specifically targeted monks who were iconophiles. He forced them to marry nuns in the Hippodrome and stole monastic property for the benefit of the state or the army. By the end of his reign, iconoclasm had gone as far as to brand relics and prayers to the saints as heretical. Well, after he died, there was a huge pushback against his movement, and iconophiles, people who supported icons, came back to power. They considered his death a divine punishment. In the 9th century, his remains were dug up and they were thrown into the sea. Well, his name Copronymus, dung-named, comes from a made-up story that when he was a baby being baptized, he lost control of his bowels in the baptistry. So just showing that he was full of it from birth. Well, there's no reason to believe that story is true. It's a funny anecdote and explains why he's named what he is. But keep all this in mind as we're looking about legends. And hey, I'll even give you one more. Francis of Assisi, a beloved saint who spoke with animals. There's a legend that when his mother, Lady Pica, could not give birth to Francis in the comfort of her house, when she was taken down to the stable, she joyfully gave birth to the boy Francis. So this oratory is supposed to show that there's a foreshadowing of his life where he openly accepted poverty, and he also loved animals, and didn't want any sort of comfortable birth, but wanted to be born literally into poverty. This isn't in any of the oldest accounts of Francis's life. They only start to come around about 100 years after it. That's because the purpose of these stories is to portray Francis as a saint who lived in perfect conformity with Christ in all the moments of his life, from his birth to his death. All right, well, that was a very long detour about source criticism. Just got to cover myself because we're dealing with a lot of stories here where we don't have good reason to believe that many of them are true, but they're so much fun, just can't help myself. And as many historians would say, just because something isn't true, that doesn't mean that they aren't useful stories. They can tell us about the intentions of the writers themselves. Why do they fictionalize this account? What does it say about the time period in which the historians themselves are writing, even though they're purporting to cover a figure that lived decades or centuries before them? So we can't throw these out because they can still be valuable. Okay, well, let's get back into things. I'd like to tell you the story of Charles VI of France, the king who is made of glass. He lived from 1368 to 1422. Now, fate was never kind to Charles VI. He was known in his earlier life as the Beloved, but later earned the nickname the Mad. He had the kingship thrust upon him when he was 12 years old because of his father's death and reigned during the Hundred Years' War, a grueling battle between England and France over dueling claims of imperial rule. At this time, English kings were really more French than they were English, and English and French territory went back and forth on the European mainland and the island. This is also where you see people like Joan of Arc appear on the scene. During this conflict, Charles saw his subjects killed in massive numbers through war, disease, and civil disorder, because France lost much of the Hundred Years' War until Joan came on the scene. Charles VI served as King of France from 1380 to 1422, and in his reign, he was forced to cede power and even members of his family to the English, which slowly destroyed his sanity. Another factor was at play, too. Madness ran in the king's bloodline as a sad outcome of intermarriage between relatives, as European kingdoms paired up their children to gain rights to each other's territories. England and France claimed each other's lands in the Hundred Years' War because their royal lines were so intertwined. All of Europe's other rulers were related as well, resulting in genetic defects and hereditary diseases on numerous thrones. So at this point, just about any monarch or any royalty or even minor bishop in Europe would be some sort of descendant of Charlemagne and probably William the Conqueror. From Queen Jean to Charles VI and on to his daughter Catherine of Valois, the tendency toward insanity was a perpetual threat in the family. It was said that in an effort to align and eventually acquire France as part of his empire, English King Henry V married Catherine of Valois and unawares opened the door for madness to contaminate his bloodline. Early in his reign, Charles VI was married to Isabeau of Bavaria. He was taken with her, even though he didn't speak German and she didn't speak French. Considering the circumstances, their marriage soon proved to be an unhappy one. His mental state began to break down due to the stresses of his position. Charles VI was given to extreme paranoia throughout his life. Paranoia might be reasonable for someone in his position, since some historians theorize that he suffered from schizophrenia, and his job required him to consider political calculations and plots against him and coming from his enemies, but possibly even people in his court. Such considerations quickly had their effect on his sanity. For Charles VI, the madness first became apparent after a bout with typhoid. The king and his entourage were crossing the Leman Forest. It was a very hot day, and the princes trailed behind the king to minimize the dust so that Charles wouldn't get dirty. As the story goes, a man appeared and loudly warned the king that he was being set up and had been betrayed. The man was dressed in a white smock and appeared to be raving, so the men-at-arms forced him away from the king and sent him on his way. But the episode filled Charles with worry. Moments later, when a page holding a lance dozed off atop his horse in the heat, the lance cracked across the helmet of another page, and the king, catching the glimmer of light as the sun reflected off the lance, jumped off his horse, drew his sword, and ran four of his guards through before he was able to be subdued. Afterwards, he passed out from heat stroke and was in a coma for 4 days. Through different accounts, he had 44 similar episodes throughout his reign. Charles would have long periods of insanity, sometimes as long as 9 months in duration, followed by short spells of clarity. But even during his times of clarity, his memory was compromised and he was unable to participate in decision-making, other than casting the deciding vote for imperial matters between his uncles and his brother, Louis of Orleans. His bouts with madness soon became a part of his daily life. Charles would run from room to room in his palace, afraid that would-be assassins were waiting to attack him. When physicians came to assist him and deliver his food, he would claw and bite those who entered his private apartment. The most well-known case of his insanity involved bouts with the glass delusion. This is a psychiatric disorder recorded in the late Middle Ages in which the sufferers believed themselves to be made out of glass and likely to shatter into pieces. As a result, he refused to allow others to touch him and wore protective clothing to prevent himself from shattering. To maintain a perfectly serene environment, he required all the windows in his palace to remain shut and that anyone who approached him do so on tiptoe. Despite these maladies, he didn't rule as a cruel tyrant. King Charles VI was well-liked and never removed his king. The high point of the reign was in the last decade of the 14th century, in which he dismissed his uncles and reinstated his father's advisors, bringing political and economic stability to his kingdom. Nevertheless, political power was taken from him when it became clear he could not effectively make decisions or concentrate for long periods of time. His uncles and brother often made decisions in his stead during his dark periods. This resulted in severe infighting between his brothers, Louis of Orleans and John the Fearless, Duke of Burgundy. Chaos and conflict engulfed France for much the rest of Charles VI's reign. He died in October 1422. The legacy of Charles VI lives on in literary works that chronicle his tragic descent into insanity. Most notably, the works The Notebook of Malt Lords Brig and Blood Royal. His legacy directly affected the neighboring countries of Europe shortly after his death. Thanks once again to the policies of royal intermarriage, he passed on mental illness to his grandson, Henry VI of England. His own battle with insanity and inability to govern England led to dynastic struggle known as the Wars of the Roses. Sadly, Charles VI's mental instability was the gift that kept on giving throughout Europe. All right, the next person we're going to look on our docket is Ibrahim I. Ibrahim was a sultan of the Ottoman Empire, and as I often like to do on this show, I look at the Ottoman Empire because that's my research background, but I also think it has a riches of historical examples that can complement things that are going on in the Western world. But its historical evolution is different enough that it can have some good counterexamples of what's going on. Let's look at Ibrahim I, or Ibrahim the Mad, as he's known today in Turkey. Ibrahim probably developed his mental illness due to his upbringing that was a direct result of the ruling structure of the Ottoman Empire. The Ottomans were a dynasty that existed from 1300 to 1923, and in many senses, it was the most successful dynasty of its kind in all of Europe in the Middle Ages. It went from father to son, well, not directly from father to son, but the same family ruled the empire for over 30 sultans, much longer than anything comparable in Europe, and they cracked the code of not having their empire fracture the way that monarchies in Europe did for two reasons. The first is that the title of the sultan only went to male heirs. You didn't have any queens in the Ottoman Empire. The concubines and wives of sultans, who became the mother of future sultans, were members of the harem. They were almost always foreign-born, often of Christian background from lands like Greece, Crimea, the Caucasus, so they didn't come in with a bundle of their own inheritance rights the way that European queens do. You don't see an Eleanor of Aquitaine or something like that in the Ottoman Empire. The second reason is that there was a brutal and effective means of transferring power from one sultan to the next sultan without having the empire break out in all-out civil war and having the empire fracture completely. Now, there still were civil wars, so the system wasn't perfect, but you don't see something like the Mongol Empire, where Genghis's sons each take a chunk of the empire, and then the entire empire essentially splits only a few generations after Genghis's death. That's not the case in the Ottoman Empire, and I'm mentioning all this preamble because this system is what produces Ibrahim. So for three centuries, the Ottoman selection of princes worked according to a simple but brutal system. Young princes of the sultan were sent to distant provincial cities to rule as governors and learn the art of politics and administration. Okay, so far. When their father died, the princes rushed back to Istanbul to be the first to claim the throne and earn allegiances of high-level advisors in the military. Now, it wasn't just a capture-the-flag game because princes were consciously working out how to secure enough support and power that by the time their father dies, they're in a position to be sultan. Ottoman dynastic succession allowed any son of the sultan to be next in line. You don't have to be the oldest son by any means. This meant any son, regardless of age, could become the sultan. This also meant that any brother of the current sultan could take his throne if he could force him out. Well, a new sultan was aware of this perpetual danger. As long as brothers lurked around in the background, he faced the possibility of being deposed, which could happen in a losing war, famine, any of the problems that come with politics. Any sultan who reigned long enough would manage to offend some part of his population, who in turn could throw their support behind a challenger. Young sultans accounted for this threat in the beginning of their reign in the most draconian manner possible. Upon being named sultan, all of his brothers and pregnant concubines were killed in order to eliminate another claimant to the throne. Sultan Mehmet III, who ruled from 1566 to 1595, killed an estimated 27 of his preteen brothers. The practice was considered barbaric by the public and routinely condemned. But according to the political logic of the Ottoman dynasty, it was an act of mercy on society and saved tens of thousands of lives because the empire wasn't plunged into a brutal civil war. This all changed with the ruler Sultan Ahmet, who's right before Sultan Ibrahim. He had an insane brother, Mustafa, on whom he took pity and couldn't consign to execution. But he also couldn't let him live freely, since an enemy faction could rise up against Ahmet and place Mustafa on the throne and use him as a puppet. Ahmet struck a balance and set him to live in confined quarters of an ornate section of the harem. Mustafa stayed in this luxurious but restrictive apartment until his death. These quarters became known as the kafes, or the cage, the golden cage. They were so effective in eliminating the threat of a dynastic rival that the cage became precedent among sultans. Soon, young princes stopped being sent out to the provinces in their youth and were instead placed in these quarters. There they stayed from their birth until their accession to the throne. They didn't win the throne, they were kept there throughout their lives under strictly controlled conditions. Being confined to a restricted space for the entirety of one's life resulted in princes with poor mental health. And Ibrahim, our subject of examination, was the most notorious example. He was kept prisoner here for all of his life, except during his short, troublesome reign. And as an aside, this provided an extraordinary opportunity for his mother, Qusem, to basically rule through her son. She ruled through her son, Ibrahim, and then another one, Murad. And this is a period of time in Ottoman history called the Sultanate of Women. Women weren't actually sultans, but they would rule through weaker sons or husbands. And some historians look down upon this period as the downfall of the empire. But you have some of the most powerful women in the world at this time in the Ottoman Empire. So Ibrahim lives a life of contradictions. He grows up in one of the most beautiful palaces on earth, Topkapı Palace, at the seat of the strongest empire in Europe and the Middle East, and the royal court could provide him with practically any material good to satisfy his desires, but he's basically living as a prisoner his entire life. This seclusion amplified his already weak mental state from birth, and his insanity reached full bloom upon being released from the cage and ascending the throne. All right, so his brother is Murad IV. Murad doesn't kill Ibrahim like he does his brothers because he doesn't consider him a threat to the throne. In the final days of the reign of Murad IV, the Sultan's dying wish was to have his brother killed. There were no others in the royal line to take the seat as Sultan, but Murad thought it better to end the family's reign than to have a madman as Sultan. But this order was not carried out, and he ascended the throne. Well, unsurprisingly, a shut-in who had been forced to live like an agoraphobe was poorly prepared to lead a global empire that spanned three continents. Ibrahim I spent his entire rule satisfying his carnal desires and occupying himself with an endless parade of virgins for his satisfaction. His harem of nearly 300 wives and concubines, including virgins from various parts of the empire and beyond. Ibrahim attempted to fashion himself as a ruler from antiquity, straight out of legend. As a self-anointed marksman, he practiced archery on subjects within his range. Some chronicles claim, and again, taken with a grain of salt, a story of Ibrahim developing a craze for scents and furs, and feeding it by imposing an amber and fur tax on his subjects. He was inspired by stories recounted by his palace court members of legendary princes of old who covered themselves, their furniture, and their entire palaces in expensive furs. He called upon his imperial council, the ulama, and military officials to collect furs throughout the empire to make this dream a reality. Ibrahim's power had always been heavily circumscribed, but episodes such as these convinced military leaders and palace court that his rule needed to be further curtailed. But whenever you have a powerful sultan who's not fully stable, you'll have hanger-oners and charlatans who try to make use of the situation. One person he came under influence by was Karabaşzade Hüseyin Efendi, who was called Cinci Hoca, literally Hoca of Jin. He was an Ottoman spiritualist who was kind of like a Rasputin of the court. He pretended to cure the sultan's physical ailments and was kept in close contact with the sultan. He and his allies enriched themselves with bribes and eventually usurped enough power to get the execution of the Grand Vizier, Kara Mustafa. He's the top administrator in the empire. This charlatan, Cinci Hoca, became High Judge of Anatolia. And other people gave Ibrahim bad advice, such as encouraging him to invade Malta, which resulted in a necessary and long war with Venice that lasted 24 years. There were sieges on Istanbul, where people were lacking food and starving, and then Ibrahim was living in total luxury and decking himself out with furs everywhere. You can imagine how popular this makes him. He also raised his favorite concubines to the position of royal consort and granted each of them riches and land. One of the things that he's best known for is for his concubine, Şekerpare, or Şekerpare, piece of sugar, literally what that name means. He had developed a preference for full-figured women, which was a popular image of beauty at that time, since due to malnourishment, many women tended toward the slimmer side and being full-figured was a sign of beauty. And he commissioned his advisors to find for him the largest women in the world to add to his harem. What they found was a woman called Şekerpare or Şekerpare. You'll see it spelled in different ways. An Armenian woman weighing 300 pounds, really large in the 17th century. Ibrahim became obsessed with her and she became quite influential in his life and had his ear on political matters, much to the dismay of Ibrahim's mother, Qusem Sultan, who continued to jockey for rule of the empire through her son. According to legend, Şekerpare told the sultan that one of his concubines had been unfaithful to him and was plotting against him, but she didn't know which one. Despite having some of the girls in his harem tortured, Ibrahim was still unsuccessful in finding out the identity of the woman who betrayed him. In a fit of rage, the sultan ordered his entire harem to be bound, sacked, weighed down and thrown into the Bosphorus. Only a handful of women were spared, including Shikarpara, and a wife, Turhan Hadice, who birthed his first son. While this event didn't go over well with Ibrahim's mother Qosem, like I said, she was able to act as a co-sultan, basically, Qosem had Shikarpara strangled and then told Ibrahim that she had died unexpectedly. By then, several of his concubines had given birth to sons, which meant the Ottoman lineage could live on and Ibrahim was suddenly replaceable. He had few supporters at this time. Ibrahim had increased taxes and was draining the local economy of resources in order to support his extravagant tastes. Military and religious leaders sought to finally depose the mentally unstable sultan. They went to the highest religious legal authority in the empire, the Shayul Islam, and sought a fatwa declaring his deposition legal. When it became clear that Ibrahim's 7-year-old son, Mehmet IV, would replace him, his associates asked how a child could lead the empire. The religious ruling from the Shayul Islam read that a madman should not reign, whatever his age, much preferred as a child with reason. It said, with such a reign, a wise vizier can restore order, but an adult sovereign, without reason, ruins his empire through murder, shame, and corruption. Ibrahim I was deposed and put back into the cage. It was said that his wails could be heard all over the palace and even outside the palace walls. A week after landing back in the same prison in which he had grown up, the executioners came into the cage and strangled him. He finally succumbed to the silk rope. Now let's move on into more modern history with some of our few remaining figures. One leader famously depicted in fiction for his losing grip on reality is British King George III, who lived from 1738 to 1820. He was king at the time in which he lost the American colonies. Now, despite his royal surroundings, George suffered from the poor medical care that was designed to cure his madness. Medicine was still in a primitive state at the time, and his physicians didn't know that treatments such as blistering and purges or binding him into a straitjacket and chaining him to a chair would negatively modify his mental state. His rule began at a tumultuous time in his nation's history. By the end of the 18th century, Britain was in trouble. The French monarchy had been toppled. Napoleon Bonaparte, a cunning and determined military strategist, had come up through the ranks during the French Revolution, conquered France, and decided to rule it as its own. Now he had his eye on Great Britain. The threat of going to war with France was a clear danger, particularly after France had helped secure America's independence through military assistance in the Revolutionary War. If ever there was a time when a kingdom was in need of a leader who had his wits about him, this was it. Unlike other leaders known for mental instability, George didn't suffer from the onset of madness. George didn't suffer from the onset of madness until well into his 50s. However, his mental instability defined the rest of his reign because it occurred during an enormously important time in European history. By October 1788, the king started showing signs of trouble. The king, known as Farmer George for his love of nature and agriculture, began ignoring the laws of nature and attempted to plant a stake, perhaps hoping to create a new species of meat-producing tree. His madness became more pronounced in the years after Great Britain had lost the American colonies in the Revolutionary War, and the king was found outside Windsor Castle shaking the branches of a tree as if shaking hands with a man. The tree, he insisted, was King Frederick the Great of Prussia, who had by that time been dead for 2 years. The king's condition worsened. He suffered frequent bouts of panic attacks and depression. He experienced hallucinations, along with a list of physical ailments such as achy joints, insomnia, abdominal pain, and seizures. While he was not immediately deposed, several unsuccessful assassination attempts were made on his life. By the end of 1788, his symptoms were unmanageable and his doctors could find for him no relief. In early November, the king and his son, George IV, got into a conflict which resulted in the king grabbing his son and trying to smash his head against the wall. An observer commented that the king was foaming at the mouth and his eyes were so bloodshot that they had the appearance of a currant jelly. The king was restrained and placed in a straitjacket and strapped into an iron chair, where he spent much time while undergoing violent mood swings. His physicians tried several cures on the monarch, but medicine was in a rudimentary state in the late 18th century, and knowledge of mental illness was non-existent. Mental disorders fell under the umbrella category of madness and were treated with therapies that were often ineffective at best and destructive at worst. Other treatments included placing poultices of Spanish fly and mustard all over the king's body in order to produce painful blisters to draw out the evil humors, an application of the Aristotelian notion of the body being made up of four primary liquids of black and yellow bile, phlegm, and blood that needed to be kept in proper proportion. The doctors believe him cured in 1789 and could carry on his duties. Well, to his credit, between 1788 and 1804, he led his country through a victory in the war against France and signed a peace treaty, though he didn't think the period of peace was by any stretch of the imagination permanent. By 1810, George was still on the throne, but he was no longer making decisions. By then, he was blind from cataracts and teetered between seasons of wellness and madness. The king had recently lost his youngest daughter, Princess Amelia, and reportedly had long crying spells and bouts with melancholy. Within a year, the Regency era began as George IV ruled in his stead, and the king spent longer and longer periods in spells of madness until he no longer recovered from them and was sequestered in Windsor Castle. And this is where he died. But in an ironic epilogue to his life, researchers put forward a theory in 2003 that the same medicines his physicians prescribed to cure his insanity may have accelerated it. A British Museum worker discovered an envelope in a vault that contained a lock of King George's hair. When the hair was tested, it contained over 300 times the toxic level of arsenic. The source of the toxin could have come from any number of products used in the time. Skin cream and wig powder contained it in significant levels 200 years ago, but no amount of those substances had that much arsenic, even before its poisonous properties were understood. The answer to the mystery came from the Royal Pharmaceutical Society. George's physicians gave him a medicine called antimony that had extremely high levels of arsenic. This chemical could have triggered an attack of porphyria, a rare genetic disease that affected the brain and nervous system. It plagued George's ancestors, like Charles VI, and caused severe pain, seizure-like epileptic fits, and severe depression. In an attempt to help the monarch avoid madness that had ended the careers of so many other monarchs, his doctors only accelerated it.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
For our last two insane rulers, we're going to jump into the 20th century. The first is Albanian leader Enver Hoxha. He was an isolationist who lived from 1908 to 1985, and he managed to out-Stalin Stalin. Enver Hoxha led communist Albania for over 40 years after the country experienced centuries of Ottoman rule and Italian occupation. And he was in fact named after Enver Pasha, an Ottoman leader and part of the triumvirate that led the empire during the First World War. As a disciple of Joseph Stalin, he forced a socialist revolution on the small country with a thoroughness that surpassed even the USSR. He pushed a backward nation of largely illiterate agricultural workers into massive social upheaval by nationalizing banks and businesses and promulgating a national language. And to diminish opposition, he crushed all forms of religion by closing down churches and mosques, turning Albania into the world's only officially atheistic country. Befitting Stalin's legacy, he also executed over 5,000 and jailed 35,000 rivals. This included both Christians and Muslims, recalcitrant peasants, in general, most anyone who criticized his methods. So when we look at Enver Hoxha's life, we're not talking about mental illness resulting from genetics or bad upbringing. We're getting into the area of being an old-fashioned megalomaniac. You can see that in the physical remains that litter the Albanian countryside today. Monuments to Hoxha's deep-rooted suspicion of a foreign attack over the country in the form of dome-shaped, steel-reinforced cement bomb shelters are everywhere. The structures were designed to prepare the nation for an invasion. However, Enver Hoxha ordered so many built that, in proportion to Albania's population, if the United States were to construct a similar proportional number in their country today, they would have approximately 50 million total. They're so prevalent and kitschy that a few savvy merchants have capitalized on these eyesores by creating miniatures for tourists to take with them as a reminder of their visit to Albania. Enver Hoxha was educated in France, and in World War II, when Italy invaded Albania, instead of joining the Albanian Fascist Party, he instead turned his small tobacco shop into a communist cell and later founded the Albanian Communist Party. In 1944, Enver Hoxha became Prime Minister of Albania and served as leader of the country until his death in 1985. During his 40-year reign, he worked to isolate Albania from the outside world and perpetually feared and prepared for an invasion from either the U.S. or Russia. He had good relations with Stalin and received considerable aid from the USSR during this time by courting the powerful ally in order to prevent threats from Yugoslavia. However, after Stalin's death in 1953, he denounced Nikita Khrushchev for his de-Stalinization programs. Enver Hoxha turned to Mao Zedong's China for support until Mao's death in 1976. After that, Albania was isolated and Hoxha's paranoia reached its nadir. Well, in addition to the bomb shelters that were built, which works out to about one for every six Albanians, so literally everyone in Albania could go into one of these shelters, he did many other notable things. Like many dictators, he had a body double whose job was to attend public events in his place. The search for a body double, however, resulted in the kidnapping of a dentist who resembled the prime minister. The dentist was forced to undergo plastic surgery so he could be a suitable and believable body double for the dictator. During his reign, Albanians were also not allowed to own typewriters, televisions, or any device that he considered distracting residents from pursuing a communist way of life. He banned traditional grooming practices, such as growing beards, perhaps as a way to eliminate forms of religious self-expression that were popular among Eastern Orthodox and Muslim men. Although, to be fair, Peter the Great did a similar thing in the early 1700s when he wanted to change Russian fashion taste to appeal more to European tastes, especially the French. In keeping with the value of self-reliance and isolation, Enver Hoxha occupied all of the cabinet positions in his administration. Not only was he prime minister, but he was also chairman, the minister of foreign affairs, and commander-in-chief. In accordance with communist ideals, he seized farmland from wealthy landowners and reclaimed them as community farms. Those people suffered from the decision. It enabled Albania to become self-reliant without the need for outside trade to obtain food, even though it massively restricted the availability of goods in the small nation. He was also successful in strengthening Albania's economy by allocating significant amounts of the nation's resources to industry. Despite his brutal rule, he was well-liked by many rural Albanians for increasing literacy and for bringing electricity to the mountainous countryside. These supporters of him came out in full force in 1991 when they rioted against anti-communist demonstrators who pulled down a towering statue of Enver Hoxha in Tirana's central Skanderbeg Square. Enver Hoxha's brutal actions likely resulted from what political psychologist Gerald Post calls malignant narcissism. This is caused by these factors: an absence of conscience, insatiable psychological need for power, unconstrained aggression, a paranoid outlook, and inflated sense of self-importance and grandiosity. Post added that dictators like Enver Hoxha saw themselves as messiahs that would save their people, but lived in isolated echo chambers where their opinions were constantly parroted back to them as sage advice. His megalomania and self-absorption made it impossible for him to empathize with the pain he inflicted on others. Thus, he could carry out terrible atrocities without blinking an eye. In his later years, Enver Hoxha was mostly secluded and concerned about having a proper successor to lead his political regime after he died. To ensure that the Albanian government would remain stable after his death, he ordered the executions of any party leaders or government officials he suspected might cause a problem for his successor, Ramiz Alia. He feared a power struggle between Alia and Mehmet Shehu, Prime Minister and Minister of the Interior, who was also his right-hand man since 1948. As a final chapter to his brutal and paranoid political career, Enver Hoxha is believed to have had Mehmet Shehu shot at a Politburo meeting. The official story in 1981 was that Shehu committed suicide after a nervous breakdown. To make the story more plausible, Enver Hoxha claimed he had been spying for the British, the Americans, and the Vatican for 20 years. He reinforced this lie by sending Shehu's wife to 20 years in a labor camp, where she died in 1988. Well, the final person we're going to look at in this episode, I think, is the absolute king of megalomania, and for his sheer oddball antics. He almost outdoes Sacha-Baron Cohen's character in The Dictator, and that is Turkmenistan President Turkmenbashi. He's even more over the top than Muammar Gaddafi, I think. His real name is Saparmurat Niyazov, the leader of Turkmenistan from 1985 until his death in 2006. He knew quite a bit about creating a cult of personality. He led the Central Asian nation as a Soviet republic and studied the leadership methods of the Soviet heads of state. When he became its president in 1991, following the USSR's collapse, Niyazov spent the next 15 years replacing pictures of Lenin and Stalin with pictures of himself and plastering his image in so many public buildings that he made Big Brother appear subtle by comparison. In the beginning, his personal branding campaign was intended to unite the fragile nation of 5 million and replace the Soviet ideology with a robust Turkmen national identity. By the end, however, Niyazov went wildly overboard and became a megalomaniac by committing the most basic sin in politics. He started to believe his own press. The president led the country into the 21st century. The area now known as Turkmenistan was, for time immemorial, semi-nomadic, then came under Soviet control from 1924 to 1985. After the fall of the Soviet Union in 1991, the tiny desert nation located east of the Caspian Sea was suddenly on its own. The man who had served as the area's chosen governor for the Communist Party emerged as its president. President Niyazov gave himself the title of Akbar Turkmenbashi, or Great Leader of All Turkmen, in 1993. From the time he took office as president until his sudden death in 2006, Niyazov made it his primary order of business to promote himself. Turkmenistan abounds with the most magnificent dedications, honorariums, and memorials to the country's first leader, each memorial commissioned by Turkmenbashi himself. After being appointed president for life by parliament in 1999, Turkmenbashi freely allocated massive amounts of municipal resources toward his own public praise. Multiple streets and schools were named Turkmenbashi. The name of Turkmenistan's largest port city, Krasnovodsk, was renamed Turkmenbashi. In 2002, the month of January was renamed Turkmenbashi, and the month of April was renamed to honor his mother, who died when the leader was only 8 years old. September became Ruhnama, named after a book he wrote. Under the leader's guidance, scientists named a meteorite that landed in Turkmenistan Turkmenbashi. Much like Muammar Gaddafi and Mao Zedong, his 2001 book Ruhnama, which translates to Book for the Soul, offered a combination of revisionist history, observations, moral guidelines, and poetry, and it was also required reading in all schools, and its memorization was required for graduation from school, to get a state job, and even to obtain a driver's license. Schoolchildren spent 1 day a week reading and learning the Ruhnama, and is required to be prominently featured in all bookstores and government offices. He even mandated that all imams place it beside the Quran in mosques, a bold move backed up by threats of imprisonment and torture for noncompliance. The purpose of the book was to provide moral guidance for all Turkmen regardless of educational level. This meant, of course, that only books necessary for laymen were the Quran and the Ruhnama, so Turkmenbashi ordered the closure of libraries outside of Ashgabat. If only two books mattered, why make more available? So strong was his belief in the writings that in 2006, he said he had personally interceded with Allah to ensure that anyone who read the Ruhnama 3 times would automatically enter paradise upon death. Turkmenbashi believed that his personal tastes made sense as public law for everyone. When he quit smoking following heart surgery, Turkmenbashi banned public smoking throughout the country. Female newscasters were not allowed to wear makeup because it was said to make the president uncomfortable. He believed Turkmen women were to be pretty enough without it, which under harsh studio lighting, you can imagine how well that turned out. The use of gold caps in dental work, a common dental treatment throughout much of Central Asia, was also outlawed in favor of having Turkmen chew on bones to strengthen their teeth, he said, thus not needing gold caps. He banned dogs from the capital city for their unappealing odor. Despite his death in 2006, the president's visage and voice appears post-mortem on his namesake television station, Turkmenbashi TV. The president's image is legally required to appear on the face of all watches and clocks. Turkmenbashi Vodka also bears his image. Perhaps the most well-known tribute to him, and I think this is one of the first things that appears on the Wikipedia page about Turkmenbashi, is a gold statue of him that sits atop a 246-foot arch in Ashgabat and rotates so that his arms always face the sun. Nearby is a 30-foot replica of the Runama that opens daily and broadcasts a recorded passage from the book. So whenever you think about excesses in the ancient world where pharaohs or Assyrian leaders fashion themselves as a god king, remember that it's not too different from what's happening today. During his rule, he sold natural gas reserves to Russia, the Ukraine, and Iran at reduced prices and deposited much of the earnings in his foreign accounts, earning an estimated $3 billion. Hardly any money went back to the nation, except for public works that directly honored him, as public services were cut back from even their Soviet-era levels. He replaced healthcare professionals with soldiers in all but a few hospitals to save on healthcare costs. He canceled pensions for the elderly and demanded they pay back 2 years' worth of previous pensions. This move is believed to have led to the deaths of many elderly Turkmen. But like many other crazed rulers, by all accounts, Turkmenbashi truly believed that his actions served his people. In a 2004 interview with the television series 60 Minutes, he was asked what an average citizen would think of his cult of personality. He answered that the public displays were actually a show of humility and contrition on his part. They weren't for his good, all these public works, but for the good of the average worker. He said, "If I was a worker and my president gave me all the things they have here in Turkmenistan, I would not only paint his picture, I would have his picture on my shoulder or on my clothing. I'm personally against seeing my pictures and statues in the streets, but it's what the people want." Well, those very few Turkmen that could speak freely disagreed. The New York Times analyzed the eccentricities of his rule and asked Turkmen in exile about their former ruler's self-aggrandizement. Shirali Nurmuradov, a poet who fled to Sweden, responded sharply, calling the renaming of the months as a sign of madness. "You know, there's a cult," he said, "but there's no personality. We cannot refer to him as a personality. It's imbecility, and it's progressing. There's a saying in our country, there's a limit to wisdom, but there is no limit to foolishness." Okay, so that is an overview of history's most insane rulers. Now, as I've noted here, there's been a difference in how insanity has expressed itself in power. In the past, it could be due more to mental illness, but today it seems like it's more like megalomania. So the big question is, can a cruel leader with an erratic disposition bordering on mental illness still hold on to power today? The answer to this question is both yes and no. Unlike the pre-modern era, mentally ill rulers are no longer tolerated because of their royal pedigree. In medieval politics, according to the political calculus of the time, it made sense to keep a crazed leader on the throne. Nearly all European heads of state were hereditary monarchs and part of a royal dynasty. Maintaining this dynasty helped to retain peace in the state by preventing the nobility from challenging its right to rule. Furthermore, putting a son or daughter on the throne kept territorial acquisitions from falling into the hands of foreigners, since these kings and queens were thought to be God's anointed sovereigns and had a divine right to rule. As we've seen in this episode, this divine right was thought to have even extended to the mentally challenged and mentally ill. But following Napoleon's European military victories, this monarchical system of Europe collapsed. Subjects stopped considering imperial rule a birthright belonging to kings or queens, no matter their mental health. Dynastic rule is essentially dead in global politics. You have the royal family in England, but they're ceremonial, as they are in most other countries that still have these legacy monarchies. There are exceptions like North Korea, but they're not in the political mainstream by any means. Today's modern monarchs hold very little power, and their official duties barely extend beyond waving at parades and performing other ceremonial functions. So are crazed rulers now a thing of the past? Sadly, the answer is no, especially in the case of megalomaniacs. This was not thought to be so very recently. Many foreign policy experts believe that after the collapse of the Soviet Union in 1989, that a tidal wave of democracy would cover the earth. The will of the people would force out crazed dictators that ran roughshod over their own people through popular uprisings, as had happened in East Germany. And at the time, the facts were clearly on the side of these analysts. There were triple the number of democracies in 2005 than in 1974, and many assumed there would just be a rationing effect until every nation on Earth was a democracy in one way or another. Unfortunately, recent events have shown that dictators whose thirst for power may have damaged their mental faculties are highly adaptable, and even if they're not mentally damaged, they have no problem being eccentric in front of cameras. Russian President Vladimir Putin is an excellent example. Although by no means mentally ill, he has started to nurture a personality cult by letting the many years of Russian premiership go to his head. These include macho displays of bravery flaunted in the Russian media. Some of the exploits that he's allowed to be caught on camera include shirtless hunting expeditions, hunting whales with a crossbow, scuba diving to research underwater archaeological sites, and dropping water on forest fires from the cockpit of a firefighting plane. But Putin is far more tactically clever than Turkmenbashi or Enver Hoxha. According to William Dobson's book, The Dictator's Learning Curve, Inside the Global Battle for Democracy, Putin was quoted as saying, "He who does not regret the breakup of the Soviet Union has no heart. He who wants to revive it in its previous form has no head." He realized a highly controlled system of only yes-men was ultimately a failed state because it could not gather good information because independent intelligence gathering mechanisms had been destroyed. So Putin wins elections in the popular vote, which makes it more difficult to define him as a dictator. He centralizes power through ostensibly legal mechanisms and keeps just enough trappings of electoral democracy in Russia to placate international human rights groups. He controls the legislature, but it appears to be a true functioning legislature. So modern dictators, even if they are self-absorbed and trending toward being a megalomaniac, are not stupid. They know how to adapt to the modern era. They understand that terrible forms of brutality are better carried out with greater discretion. Rather than send police to slaughter protesters in front of presidential palaces, there are far more subtle means at these dictators' disposal. They intentionally leave the law vague to give themselves legal cover to quietly suppress opposition. They send bureaucrats to shut down businesses or tax collectors to audit opposition-owned businesses. They shut down critical TV networks and newspapers for minor technicalities or legal infringements. Another example is the late Venezuelan president Hugo Chavez. He is very bombastic, but adapted himself well to modern times. When he appeared in front of the United Nations Assembly several years ago, he immediately genuflected and claimed that he smelled sulfur because the devil had been there, a reference to the spot where then-President George W. Bush had stood to deliver a speech. He ruthlessly controlled Venezuela by nationalizing industries, packing the courts with his cronies, and cracking down heavily on those in the media who opposed him. But he didn't seek absolute control. The only thing that was somewhat free was the Electoral Council that allowed quasi-open elections. That's because Chavez required an opposition. He needed them once every few years to show up on the ballot and be defeated to continue to support the illusion that he was a democratically elected leader. So with today's megalomaniacs and crazed rulers, sometimes they become so uncomfortable in their positions that the mask occasionally slips and the crazed ruler underneath reveals itself. But the mask quickly goes back up, and they cover themselves up with the pretense of being modern, enlightened, democratic leaders. They know that with the help of the trappings of democracy, they're likely not going to go anywhere. And as far as I can tell, comparing mentally unstable rulers of the past with today, rulers like them aren't likely to go anywhere. All right, well, if any of you would like me to dive deep into a question like this, you are always free to send questions or suggestions my way on what topic to cover. And you can reach out to me by going to info@historyonthenet.com, contacting me by email, or you can leave a voicemail by going to historyunplugpodcast.com. Thanks for listening and see you next time. Thanks for listening to the History Unplugged podcast. Be sure to subscribe to the show to get your daily dose of all things history related, from ancient Greece to the Cold War. You can do that by going to historyonthenet.com/subscribe. Speaking of History on the Net, if you want to dive deeper, go to our site, historyonthenet.com, and there you'll find blog posts, book reviews, and all of our other podcast episodes. Plus, don't forget to rate and review this podcast so we can bring you the best daily history content possible. We'll see you next time at the History Unplugged podcast.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you want to get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather, now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
VGW Group, no purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions, 18 plus.